Hello and welcome to episode 79 of the Beyond the Self podcast. I am your host, Africa, and I'm very excited for the conversation that you are about to listen to. I am sitting with one of my dear friends, Mark Vicente. I think some of you in this audience will be familiar with him. He is known as the whistleblower for the cult Nixxiom. And if you have no idea what that is, I have left a lot of links in the show notes so that you can get familiar with Mark and his work and who he is. What I wanted to do in this conversation, though, I wanted to go beyond that perception that people have of him, because he's someone that is very much in the public eye. But Mark is also an author, he's a speaker, and most importantly to me, he is the man that created a film that I grew up with. How many of you are familiar with the film Sarafina? He was the cinematographer for that film, and it changed so much when it comes to filmmaking in general, but the conversation around the apartheid in South Africa. Mark was born in Joburg in South Africa, and I think that's why him and I have this sort of intuitive bond that we've had from the very first time that we met, and we talk about it a little bit in this conversation. But this is someone that needs to be on your radar. This is someone that is so curious about the human condition. He's not afraid to ask questions, and like I just said, as someone that grew up in the harshest years of the apartheid, which Mark definitely did, he is no stranger to asking the hard questions, and you will see that for yourself, not only through our exchange, but in his work as well. I think I'll leave it there. I'll leave it there because I really just want him to tell you who he is, and not through him sort of rattling off his bio, but through conversation. This is hands down one of my favorite exchanges that I've had with anyone, especially publicly. And yeah, I'm very excited for you to listen to it. Let me know what you think. Do let me know what you think. Email me hello@africabrook.com. And you can also get in touch with Mark. There's, like I said, there is so much in the show notes. He's someone that is very open to collaboration. He wants to tell brave stories through film and through art and through brave conversation, which is where him and I intersect in terms of the work that we do and just our general mission. So I'm very, very thrilled that I get to bring this forward to you. And last thing that I will say is that I just want to say a big, big thank you to every single person that has ordered my book, The Third Perspective. Depending on when you're listening to this, you might be listening so far into the future, so the book already exists out there in the world. But if you're listening in real time, then yes, you can still pre-order the book and let me know or tag me in your order so that I can say thank you. But yes, I think that is everything from me. I hope that you enjoy this episode, and I can't wait to sit with you for the next one. Take care. Mark, my audience will have heard the intro that I have done without you in the room, because there's a lot that I would love to say about you. But something that I do want to reiterate in front of you is that you are someone that I greatly, greatly admire. You and I haven't known each other for a very long time, but I truly feel, and I don't say this often, I feel a soul connection for a multitude of reasons. A big part of it for me would be the part of the world that we are both from. I think naturally, being Southern African, we view the world just a little bit differently. And I think we'll be getting into that throughout the conversation. But to me, you embody a level of integrity that I just have not seen in a long, long time. I have listened to so many different public conversations you've had. I have sat with you, and you are the same person. You're exactly the same person you put forward. So this conversation, I'm so thrilled that we could have it. It means a lot to me. Selfishly, I feel like it's just for me. Also for the listener, yes, it's for you too, but I've really, really been looking forward to this. So thank you so much for carving out the time.
I feel very much the same way about you, you know, and I think it's definitely where we're from, but I think also there's a clarity that, and I mentioned this on the podcast we did previously, there's a clarity that is so refreshing. And, you know, I wanted to jump into something quickly because I was walking in the park and I was thinking about this thing you just spoke about, presenting yourself one way in public and a different way privately. And I will say, look, privately, I swear a lot more. Let's just say that. So I'm not exactly the same, exactly the same person. But I was thinking about how, you know, social media, this sort of animal is almost requiring us to be something different than we are. Like to get followers and to get this and to get that. It's sort of, you know, you look at the advice and it's urging us to be do this and do that and all the stuff that feels out of integrity to me. You know, like do these crazy thumbnails and, you know, do this and do that. And the tagline has to be really inflammatory. And I'm like, yeah, I just went through that shit getting out of a cult where they called me a sex cult official. And I'm like, you motherfuckers, what the hell? And I get it. And I spoke to the journalists. I said, why? And they said, well, for ratings. And I'm like, yeah. And humanity, what about that? What happens to humanity? And so it's got me thinking that the world right now seems to be almost urging us to be something different for acceptance.
Yes.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And
you know what I'm saying.
Of course, of course. And I think it's so easy to find yourself playing the game. And I love the examples that you used around, let's say, thumbnails and titles. And, you know, there were so many people that I used to admire and still do and used to listen to and used to get so much wisdom from, especially when I was breaking out of my own echo chambers and very cultish thinking. I just started turning to people that I had sort of discarded without really thinking much about it. And it's so interesting to see a lot of them now, even 4 years later, also playing that game of tapping into our negativity bias, you know, in the titles, the world is ending, they're out to get you, whatever it might be. And then when you click into the video, it doesn't have that at all. They're actually still just as wise as they were, but they're also playing that game. So I love that example that you use. And how do you push back on that? Because you're someone that is very visible. You're someone that is having these big conversations. How do you push back on that and remain in integrity with your voice and your message and your work?
I don't know that I always am. Because I find myself falling prey to it as well.
Yeah.
You know, I might put something up and realize, okay, well, that I could do that title differently. And I start to go down that sort of slippery slope. I think there's a certain amount of stubbornness that I feel. I feel like if I'm going to be part of that game, that I'm promoting the game, and everybody has barely a 30-second attention span right now, which is one of the reasons I love long-form discussions.
Yes, me too.
If I go down that route, then I will support what's happening. If I go the route of, you know, MTV, you know, cutting and that kind of thing, then yes, I'll have more people listening to me. But do I want those people listening to me? And what kind of message am I going to be given? So I think part of it is stubbornness. You know, people say to me, well, you should do this and you should do that and you should do this sponsorship. And I'm like, yeah, but I'm not in alignment with the idea that somebody else is going to advertise on my platform and I have no idea who they are.
Yes.
I'm not on board. So yeah, I make less money. Okay. So stubbornness, I guess, is my answer.
Yeah.
You know,
that would be mine too. And I'm glad I asked that because it's something that I speak to my audience quite a bit about. That in the past pretty much 8 years that I've been sharing in the way that I do online, there's so many people that have approached me and said things like, you know, even friends, well-meaning people who are also doing wonderful things. Mm-hmm. Your platform could be even bigger if you were to do this. You should venture onto YouTube if you were to take some of this and then place it onto TikTok and then you do. That's not what I want. That's not what I want. I've always said to myself, even before I had the platform that I do or the visibility that I do, that I'm in this for the long haul. There's no rush. What am I rushing for? There's no urgency. And I think sometimes external urgency, you can end up feeling like it's your own when it's not.
Yes.
It's not anything to do with you. It's other people's urgency, other people's plans for you. But I think that's something, especially in this climate, that can be a difficult thing to do. And it also sort of makes me think of when I first wrote my open letter, why I'm leaving the cult of wokeness. I had some people, very few people, calling me a grifter. That I, you know, it's some kind of grifting tactic and that I've been co-opted by the right and this is all about money. If I really wanted to make money, and I'm talking good fucking money, I would continue playing the game of identity politics. Why would I go the other way? And I was wondering as I was preparing for this conversation, just energetically, if you have ever experienced any of that since coming out of the cult and speaking in the way that you do, have you come across people sort of assuming, loudly assuming that this is some kind of tactic, like a financial gain thing or like a...
No, I mean, people, but again, it's a minority of people. It's like trollish people, you know, I guess who live in basements or worse. I'm not sure. You know, people say, oh, I'm a cult leader. I'm like, really? Wow. Okay. Oh, cool. Okay. Or, you know, I'm grifting off all the shit I went through. And I'm like, okay, but then how does it relate to every other person who has an experience? And then that experience informs what they want to do with some of their life, at least. Are they all grifting? You know, these arguments fall apart very quickly. But I was thinking this morning, actually, just back onto trolls for a second.
Yeah.
Bonnie and I were having this conversation. And I was thinking about these people that say these kinds of things. And I thought to myself, that's so interesting because, okay, so they say something and it's a minority. And I have the opportunity to have my inner critic activated. So now there's this pylon of my inner critic against me. And so they get to activate that. And I thought to myself, what they don't realize is that makes me more powerful. Like, I'm now going to be more powerful because what you did is you activated my inner critic. You showed me a weakness that I didn't know I had. Now you showed me the weakness. Now I know I can do something with that weakness. Now I'm going to be more powerful. You know? You know what I mean? You know what I mean?
Yes, I do. Wow. Have you always thought like that?
Yeah. I was a weird kid.
Really?
Well, I mean, not specifically this, but I mean, I just always, I was the kid that couldn't relate to people my own age. And the adults always thought, isn't he sweet? Such a little gentleman. Because I always had these, I had ideas, I guess, that were bigger than my age. That didn't mean I was more grown up, because I think there was parts of me that were less grown up. But I sort of went into my head a lot to escape stuff as a kid. But lately... And you know this, being a public figure, you just get so much harassment about this, that, or the other. You know, and I thought to myself, well, what do I do? Do I develop a thicker skin? Okay, I could do that, and I could say I don't care, but that's not true. Can I look deeper at what's going on? Okay, so the people that are saying mean things, their easiest route is criticism. Have I ever been like that? Yes, I have. When was I like that? When I was scared of trying to do something.
Yeah.
When I was scared of excellence or growth or whatever it is, then it became easier to criticize. Okay, so maybe that's what's going on with them. You know, and it's not like I'm saying, oh, I want to forgive people. No, I just want to reason it through to myself to the best of my ability. And then how can I, and this thought only came to me this morning, how can I then leverage my sensitivity to help me? And that's when I realized, they're actually helping me. It's not what they want. They don't want to acknowledge the possibility that they're going to make me more powerful. But that is what's in reality, that is what's going to happen.
Yes.
Because if I don't go down with the ship of self-loathing, then I'm going to stand tall and go, okay, so I have these thoughts about myself. That's why it mattered to me.
Yeah.
You know, if they said to me the old thing of like, well, you're purple, I don't care.
Yeah.
You know, but if they say something else to me that feels more sensitive, I'm like, actually, I do care about that. I am worried that I am that. I'm worried that I'm not enough this, or I'm too much that, or, you know, and there's also this thing of like having come out of a very coercive environment, I am being careful about how to use power. I'm worried about, you know, misusing power. So I generally tend to hold back. I generally try not to be so self-assertive that I start to come out with black and white solutions to things.
Right.
Because it's tempting.
Yeah.
I mean, I could get a seriously big following if I was very direct about this is the thing you need to do and that right. thing you're doing is going to screw up your life. I could have a mega following of people, mm-hmm. but that's not what I want. You know, after I released the film, What the Bleep Do We Know, which I directed
yes.
way back.
Yes.
I got this weird cult following, you know, all of us, my producers as well. I got this weird cult following of people thinking that, like, you know, I had the answer to everything. And it got so weird. And I realized, like, I don't want that. I don't want that, A, the level of responsibility, and then B, looking at a person who's literally handing their power to me and kind of excavating themselves while doing it. And I thought, that's terrible. You know, so it doesn't sit comfortably with me. I'm going yeah. all over the place, but you know what I'm saying.
No, this is good. This is good. I always, when I have conversations in this way, I always just want you to riff out loud and to just speak, because I think so much can come through that I didn't even know. And that's going to, yeah, I think that's all part of the story. And you just said something important there around that I'm more curious about and I want to tap into even more. Of you holding something back so that you're not being too assertive to the point of maybe aggression, to the point of maybe being so convicted and kind of absolutist in your approach, right? Do you think that is coming from a place of sort of just grounded self-awareness, or is there some sort of fear in that?
A fear of not
wanting to tell me?
It's a wound. It's a wound of some sort. It's not a fully integrated feeling
right.
that lives in my body securely. It's when I've put things out in the world, like let's take, you know, the film What the Bleep Do We Know?
Yes.
There were good things and bad things that came out of it. I think to some degree, it gave people enormous hope about things that had them think about things they hadn't thought about before. But I saw some people that were maybe already very delusional become more delusional. And I felt this feeling of like, fuck, like, how do I not screw the world up? You know? And so I think from somewhere, and I haven't dug deeply on this really, but I think there's somewhere being a kid, I must have gotten scared about the effects I had on things or people. And so I started to hold back maybe. And then as I grew, you know, as I got older and I, you know, started making films and realized I had a certain power, I didn't think about it as power. I just thought about, I have a message I want to get out and it's desperate and urgent for me to get the message out. And you just never know, like, is it going to be all good? You
yeah.
know, what if some of it's bad? You know, I was involved in an organization for a while, turned out to be a cult. I thought it was good. Turns out I was wrong. You know, so I feel very fallible. And so I feel I would like to step into a place where I can communicate as forcefully as I'm comfortable with and I like without that fear. But I have, to be honest, I have never really dug deeply into it. I think what's happened is I got to the boundaries of it and then I just avoided it.
Really?
You know? Yes.
Oof. Yeah. And because you've mentioned the film, which I wanted to bring up anyway, What the Bleep Do We Know? Can you tell us what it's about? Because I think that really gives fuller context to everything else that we're going to explore.
God, I wish I could. It was a film attempting to unify consciousness, quantum mechanics, biology, the nature of existence. You know, it was cherry picking things that had been discovered in, you know, quantum physics, and cherry picking it to try to understand the mysteries of life. And it was a very fascinating and beautiful idea. And, you know, it was sort of talking heads with scientists and, you know, neurobiologists and things, and then a lot of animation. And then we added a narrative story because we realized this is really boring. So we added a narrative story, and we got Marley Matlin to be in the film. You know, and she plays a photographer who has all these limitations and hangups and has this beautiful breakthrough and realizes she needs to love herself to get free. So there's a lot of beauty in it. And the reason it's called What the Bleep Do We Know is because I think the first title was called Sacred Science. And myself and my two producers were talking about, it's not a good title, it's a bad title. And one of my producers had said something like, blah, 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 but what the fuck do I know? Mm. And we were like, well, yeah, that's kind of cool. Why don't we just call it that? And then we realized we couldn't call it, actually say fuck, because the censors, What the Bleep Do We Know? But the thing is, that it was weird because we said What the Bleep Do We Know, but we were pretty forceful about what we believed was true.
Right.
But I will say that the film launched many powerful careers for people that were in the film. It broke new ground because what I was trying to do, you know, growing up for some time, you know, in South Africa, like there was one New Age bookstore in Johannesburg, like one. And that was, I think, in Hillbrow, and then it closed down, and then it was later in Rosebank. So it was these weird little bookstores. And I thought to myself, there's information in here about consciousness and the nature of existence that people don't know. It would be great to make something to make this mainstream. And I think What the Bleep did that. It took those ideas that were from the musty, weird bookstores, put them out in the world, and now they're very common. Now they're super, super common.
And what year was this?
So the film, we finally released the film in 2004. We started in 2001. Actually, we signed the official paperwork. I think it was on the day, the 9/11, on the actual day.
Wow.
That was the birth of the film. And then it took us like 3 years because first, as I said, it was talking heads, and then it was, okay, animation. It was trying to figure out how do you take all these ideas that are very, very complex, make it palatable and enjoyable and entertaining. Because if you don't do that, nobody cares, you know? Right. And that was a three year journey.
And I asked that because it was way ahead of its time, way ahead of its time, especially what I think of the early 2000s. Of course, I was young, but I can remember what was in the mainstream and what was not. And a film like that, for it to have reached the amount of people that it did, and for it to be a film that people still reference to this day, when speaking about all things esoteric and the link between the esoteric and the scientific, etc., it was way ahead of its time. So for that to be part of your story, where you said earlier, you got to experience a level of power and sort of what it looked like to have, would you say like a cult-like following, or to have like people that were hanging onto your every word? When you say power, what exactly did it look like and feel like at that time?
Yeah, I don't think it was power in the best and purest sense of it, which I'm not sure what that is. But I'll tell you, there was an experience I had before the film sort of hit big. You know, we were doing screenings in different places. I was in San Francisco one day doing a screening of the film, and a lot of people came. And at the end of the screening, I would always do a Q&A, you know, we always did. And a woman got up to me and asked me for advice on raising her two daughters that were with her. And I was pretty young. And I thought to myself, what? And so I said to her, could we talk afterwards? And so she said, great. So we went outside and I talked to her afterwards. And I said, you know, I'm not a parent. She goes, oh, okay. I said, no, I'm not a parent. I have no experience. You're a parent. You've raised them thus far. Please don't listen to people like me. I'm a filmmaker. I'm fascinated with these things. I don't have the answers. And I think that was one of the most shocking things to me, because I realized I do not want this. I do not want to be this person that people look to that they think has all the answers. Now, I think what I did is I went in the other direction, which is and this is, I think, partially from my childhood as well. So, well, I'm actually a piece of shit. So, like, I'm nothing and nobody and whatever. So, I felt like being sort of a servile and more of a servant was a healthier thing for the world. And I think that's made me, you know, prime fodder for, you know, leaders that wanted people that were servants.
Right.
You know, I'm a very hard worker. You know, in the Nixxiom cult, they saw, you know, me, and they saw, okay, so he produces things, he creates things, he's got this interesting mind, and he works very hard. And cults love hardworking people, you know. So I was more comfortable in that position, which is not healthy either. So in my avoidance of embracing true power, I went the other direction, which is potentially just as damaging.
I
haven't had this conversation with anybody.
Really?
Ever. I've thought these things. You know, I've had them to some degree with my wife, but I've never actually dug this deep.
Wow.
I've never thought to myself, my abdication from power led me to a place of servileness. I don't know if that's a word.
Yeah.
That is just as problematic.
Gosh. You know? Yeah. It's so interesting because that place of serving, of servitude, how I was thinking about this, right? There's still something to gain. What is there to gain there? If it's not power in the way that we sort of know it, what is there to gain?
So for me, look, I think for some people, I checked this out and it didn't feel right for me. I think for some people, being the savior is what they get. I think for me, it was being worth something, being worthy. You know, I talked in one of my podcasts about growing up in different books, you know, and some of them was like, you know, Vusama Zulukred and Mutwa. Some of them were like Herman Charles Bossman, but also then a little later, Prince Valiant comics. And Prince Valiant, you know, this savior and a horse thing was all about serving. And somewhere along the line, as a kid, I developed the idea that I wasn't good, that I wasn't worthy, and I had to become it.
Right.
So in some ways, serving and trying to help, quote-unquote, help the world, quote-unquote, save the world, meant that maybe I could finally be worthy.
Mm.
You know? So it was sort of going from minus 10 to maybe I could get to zero.
Yes.
You know, because I checked out the idea, like, is it because I want to be a savior? And I realized, no, because then when I got into a position where people saw me as a savior, I was deeply uncomfortable. Mm. I did not like it at all.
Yeah.
Ooh. I should pay you for therapy. You know that? I should be paying you for therapy.
I'll invoice you later. We'll talk about it later. And the thing is, I wonder if also taking on the role or being comfortable in the role of savior, you wouldn't be able to fully be integrated with it if there are those worthiness issues to begin with. Or do you think someone can still take on that role of being a savior and have those worthiness issues? Maybe there isn't an answer to this, but it's just something that came to mind.
I think a lot of people who lead have a lot of worthiness issues still. I'm not saying that leadership is synonymous.
Yes.
But you know, leadership can be very compensatory. I don't know how to say it. Compensatory. It covers up a lot of stuff. Like I remember, when I, you know, it was always my dream to one day be this guy, this kid that went from South Africa, I'm going to get to Hollywood. And that was my dream. And everybody, you know, I went to drama and film school in Johannesburg. Everybody knew Mark is all about Hollywood. So, you know, I get to Hollywood and I, at the age of like 26, I'm now the director of photography on a very big film. Big for me. I think it was like $34 million was the budget, which to me was like insane.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, okay, so here I am. Now I'm in charge of people twice my age and I have a massive crew. It was a big movie with Patrick Swayze.
What was the film?
Oh, it was called Fatherhood.
Oh, wow.
Was not a very good film.
Okay. And how old are you at the time?
So we can 20, get the full 26. Picture. I was 26 years old.
Wow.
So I was like one of the youngest cinematographers at that point to shoot what at that time was a big budget you know, Hollywood movie. And I get on to set the first day to somewhere in Louisiana, and there's like 16 massive trucks. You know how big those trucks are. Massive trucks pull up. And the director and I are talking, and I realize, like, he tells me what he wants, and now it's my job to tell everybody else, who's like, you know, 300 people, what we're going to do. And I was terrified. And I thought to myself, so here I am. I didn't think this at the time. It was after the film. I thought, there I was in this position of enormous power and authority. The thing I wanted to get to Hollywood, you know, I wanted to become somebody. And I'm terrified. And I was terrified the entire film. And it's interesting because later, you know, one of my favorite composers is Hans Zimmer. And Hans Zimmer was talking about, I think he was talking about, what was the amazing film? Why am I blanking? About space that he...
Interstellar?
Christopher Nolan. Interstellar, thank you. He was talking about Interstellar and he was being interviewed and he was asked a question about it. And he says, I am terrified every time I start a film because I think to myself, what if there's nothing in there? Yeah. What if nothing comes? And I think to myself, Hans Zimmer, I mean, genius. Interstellar is one of the greatest soundtracks ever.
Oh my goodness.
And I thought, oh, that's just normal.
It's normal, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's a very long way to answer.
No. This is good. I love a long answer. I love a long, make it as long as possible, please. Thank you. I love this so much because in my work and in my own life, so I work with people that are in the public eye, people that are hyper visible, different types of leaders, entrepreneurs, creative geniuses, whatever it might be, also teachers, people that have a lot of responsibility, essentially. We all have worthiness issues on some level. Some have more than others. And I always think to myself that actually with all of this, it's not about ridding any of that. I think it's about learning to observe, just to observe all of these things, all of these little mind gremlins that come up. And, you know, imposter syndrome is one of them. Or one day people are going to find out that I'm not actually that great at the job. Now I'm working on a shoot and it's, you know, the budget is 50 million, whatever it might be. They're going to find out that I have no idea what I'm doing. Even if I've done 10 films before, you know, there's, I think there's, so I wonder if with all of this, because my original thing was, can you be in that role comfortably of savior if you have worthiness issues? And I think you can actually. And I wonder if a lot of people that do have worthiness issues take on that role because they feel like they have to prove something.
Yeah. And also, yes, absolutely. And also, you know, the whole savior thing, I mean, it's so arrogant. Saving who?
Right.
Why? And how do you decide who needs saving? Maybe you need saving, you know?
Right. So
The whole savory thing is insane. But I do think, I do think that we all have something like that. And one of the things I've learned recently, this is pretty, I'd say the last 2 years, this idea, which I think you're very familiar with. Those voices, that inner critic, we fight it our whole life. And the thing that we don't realize is it just grows. You know, the more we fight it, it just grows. And it feels worse and worse. It isn't worse and worse. But like the more you lock it in a dark little closet, you start to imagine it's this terrible, 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 terrible thing until one day somebody, you know, maybe like yourself, you know, who's mentoring somebody or, you know, a psychologist, you know, helps the person open the door and they realize it's this little pipsqueaky thing that's just terrified. I found that acknowledging the voice now, acknowledging the criticism, the critic, is so much better because it relaxes. Yes. And what I've been able to do more recently is include everything in the moment. So I am leading this thing. I have a lot of skills that help me lead this thing, and I am scared. Not but, and I am scared. And the minute I would do that, I start to feel less desperation and more adventurousness. Like now I'm an adventure because like, oh, there's all this stuff I don't know. You know, and then you work better with people. When you're leading a team or working with a team, when you acknowledge your fear and what you don't know, you work better because then you listen to people who have ideas that are better, same or worse than yours.
Absolutely.
And suddenly you're like, oh, this is a lot of fun. Like, so I know this stuff and I don't know that stuff. They happen to know that stuff. Let me ask them what they think. You know, it becomes this incredibly collaborative thing. And I've found that those are the leaders I like. And that's the kind of leader I am aspiring to be. That people feel a kind of invigoration because they feel like they can bring something to the table.
Yes.
Because I don't have a chip on my shoulder, something I'm trying to prove. And the truth is, you know, when you deal with somebody who has a lot to prove to the level that it's toxic, pretty much everybody knows that they're insecure.
Absolutely.
They're the only one that doesn't know it.
Yes.
Everybody else, you know, you walk onto, this is always interesting, you know, when you're, you know, working on film sets, this doesn't happen to me now because this was long before, you know, when you're like a camera operator or whatever and you're day playing on something, you come on for a day and you look around and you try to understand what's going on. And so what you do is you go to the people that work, you know, it's the grips and the gaffers and the makeup and the hair and the wardrobe. And, you know, you say, like, what's up? And they go, oh, well, you know, this is happening and this is, and that one's a piece and that one's doing cocaine all the time. And they're about to like overdose one day. She's fucking so, and he's screwing this one. And you get to lay the land very, very quickly.
Yes.
And you're like, oh, that's what's going on. Because those are the people, the laborers that we are.
Yeah.
Those are the people that make everything. We know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And when you work with people like that, that are very, very aware, I think the best way to be a leader is to share openly and say, okay, I'm not sure what we should do about this. What do you think?
Absolutely.
And not pretending you don't know, like you really don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, people love that. I love it. I love it when I'm working with somebody that says, look, I'm trying to do this thing. I don't know how to do that. And also because, you know, you mentioned, what the bleeping groundbreaking. I mean, it took 3 years because we're trying to figure out how to do it. Every right. single project, I don't know why this is. I don't choose easy stuff. I choose stuff that when I'm trying to do something that I haven't seen before, that I'm trying to figure out how to do it. And the truth is, I sometimes wake up in the morning, I don't know, but I trust. This is my trust in the creative process right now. I trust that the answer is going to come.
Me too.
I don't know
yes.
where it's going to come from. So it's almost like I get this feeling of like this emptiness, like this desert of like, I don't know. And that desert used to be terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
Now what happens is I feel the emotional desert of I have no idea what to do about this thing. And now I have excitement because I know that after the desert, an object will appear in the desert. And when I say desert, I'm not talking about a desert with like nice sand dunes. I'm talking about the desert like flat
barren.
With shimmering heat and there's nothing, you know?
Yes. Oh, yeah. I love that because I'm so similar. I'm so similar in my creative process. Even when I think of writing, when I was writing The Third Perspective,
yeah.
I knew 4 years ago that I wanted to write this book and I was going to write it. And I'm so grateful that Ivan, my incredible agent, he's an Irish man. He's in his 60s. He's so politically incorrect, but he's the most liberal person I know. He's just so wonderful. And he's similar to me in that even though he knows and we're very transparent about business and the work that we're here to do, we want to sell a shit ton of copies of this thing. And at the same time, there's no rush. There's no urgency. He was always telling me that this book, Africa, is going to tell you what it needs to be. You don't need to tell the book what it is, okay? Because when you try to do that, that's when you're going to force yourself to write it in 6 months so you can please publishers.
Yeah.
But actually, if it takes 3 years, 4 years, 5, 10, just listen to it and it will tell you what it needs to be.
So wise.
Oh my goodness. And that's exactly how I work and what I'm like with everything I do. And I'm so grateful that I've had this level of conviction from the very beginning, even before I had anything, you know, complex that I was doing.
Yeah.
I just knew that it needs to feel, even if it feels very frightening and scary and I have no idea of the how, there's a level of integrity I need to feel in my creative process.
Yes.
And I know what that feels like. I do.
Yes.
Because there's been so many things that can be presented as an opportunity, but actually they're not. They're not an opportunity at all.
Yeah.
It's just a very shiny and costly distraction, you know? So I love what you're saying about that visual of the desert, that actually it's not scary at all. It's a place of curiosity. It's a place of exploration. It's a place of honoring what is instead of trying to construct something that isn't there.
Yes,
you know? Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, I want to pick up on something you said because it got me thinking, you know, sometimes people would say to me, like, I love how you're so forthright and you're this and you're that, which is I experience of you as well.
Yeah.
And then I think to myself, yeah, but they don't see the hours, days, months, and years that I wrestle with something before I do it.
Yes, yes.
They don't see that part. And that's not bad. That's good. But I'm like you. Like, I don't want to do something until I've really wrestled with the thing.
Yes.
You know, and that's part of the process. And I think what's happened is because of our culture right now where you see the final product, you don't realize, no, that final product you're seeing of that person didn't just appear. There's a lifetime's worth of stuff behind that. But I wrestle, you know, with things. And I feel like I'm assuming that you do as well, because listening to your podcast, I'm like, yes. Hey, she's wrestling on the air.
Yes. Right? Yes. Oh, and you know what I love where this conversation is going, because it's something I think about often, in that I decided maybe a few years ago, maybe before that, but specifically to do with my work and my creative process, to bring my audience in, because I am also creating that perception where I would come forth with something that is finished or announce something, and then the next time I talk about it, it's finished. So I think we also play a part in that perception, because we're not showing the behind the scenes. But I saw how transformative it was when, from the moment that I decided that I was going to write the book, I started sharing that. And every time that I would go to, and I'm not a big sharer, I'm a very private person. I share snippets of my life, but you're not going to see everything. I'm similar to you in that we share snippets, but you know, we're private people.
Yeah.
But I would share that, you know, I'm going to the coffee shop to write today. This is what I've written, share aspects of it. So now that the book is out, I haven't done the thing that most authors do, which is announce that they have a book deal, announce that it's available for pre-order, and then announce that it's gone to publish. But when you speak to authors, they will tell you how horrifying that process was, how many rejections they faced, how they hate the cover they've ended up with, how they, you know, had to change their title. You know, that it's been that maybe they didn't even write the book, but they're not talking about the many people that were involved in the actual process. So I realized that the perception, how people are experiencing me, I have a very big part to play in that, you know, because if I overly curate myself, how else are they supposed to? Of course, they're going to assume that I've always had this level of success and ease, or that everything has sort of just happened. But if I invite them, even just a little bit, even if you're creating a film or something like that, let your audience know what it is you're doing. Ask them questions. I started to ask my audience early on questions like, if I was to write a book, what would it be about? Even that level of interaction, right? So I can have an idea of what are they expecting of me versus what am I actually doing, but not so I can mold and change for them, but just so I can actually sort of demystify the process is what it is.
Yeah.
I realized that it actually feels good for me to demystify the process. And I humanize myself in doing so, because then I'm not putting forward this image of perfection. Things always work out. And I love that I have my podcast, because then I can really riff out loud and share the realities of what's happening behind the scenes. And then on social media, I will share the actual writing process, my 1,006 postcards that I wrote the book on, note cards rather, that I wrote the book on. I'll share that. So I'm right there with you. And I realize that there's a part that I'm playing in that perception that we're both upholding this thing, you know? Yeah.
Yes. And also the thing, you know, I love about you and the way you express. So you model vulnerability in the sense that it's not modeling really. It's that you are expressing vulnerability and you're making it acceptable for people to feel theirs and express theirs. And it's interesting when you and I get together, we just share.
Yeah.
You know, the last time we had that amazing, amazing dinner in the evening, it was, I don't know, we went on for 3.5 hours, you, me, and Bonnie just yakking away.
Yeah.
And it's lovely. And I will tell you something interesting, because in the cult, there's a lot of sharing that goes on because you feel like you have to. And so when I left, I was like, I'm not fucking sharing anything with anybody. Screw you all.
Really?
You know? And then when the vow came out, there was so much scrutiny on me, people demanding answers for things. And I was like, you know what? Fuck you all. Like, I'm not in a cult anymore. Screw you. So it took me a while to recapture speaking vulnerably. And I think I have enough. But what happens, you know, with people, with someone like you, because, you know, if I asked you a question, you know, we're having dinner, you'll just tell me the answer to the best of your ability. And so it invites people to dig in and say, well, yeah, what do I feel about this thing? That's the other thing I think is important and an antidote to this, you know, what I call this, you know, the YouTube short TikTok phenomena, which is, you know, to truly deeply connect to one's vulnerability and then, you know, decide how much you want to share. But I do think that when you do share some or all of it or whatever, you give people permission to tap into their own humanness.
Yes.
Which is the thing that feels like it's under assault in the world. You know, it feels like it's being eradicated. And those are the podcasts and the people I love listening to. I love listening to your podcast because every time I listen, you're going to talk about something you're feeling. And I get to check in and I go, like, am I feeling that? Like, oh, yeah, I do feel that. The last one you did on rejection was so interesting to me. I remember exactly where I was walking because I listened so carefully. And as I was walking along, I thought to myself, you know, I don't give myself permission to acknowledge when I feel the thing that Afric is describing right now. And because I don't give myself the permission to acknowledge it, I don't get to process it. I'm just avoiding it. And now I'm terrified of rejection. And so now what happens is, you know, is I sort of think back and I go, so are there doors I haven't been through because of this fear? There might be doors I haven't been through. Let me look at some of the doors recently that I think were available to me that I didn't go through because there's this feeling that I am terrified of having. And then I have to go, now remember, Mark, you can be driven and you can be ambitious and you can be afraid of rejection and it's okay. Right?
Yeah, that's huge. Thank you. Thank you for that reflection, for sharing that, because I remember when I was recording that episode, I said something in there that spoke to how I always respond when something isn't going right or there's kind of a spanner in the works or it's a rejection or, you know, whatever the thing might be, my mind goes into solution. And when I think of my upbringing, it makes total sense. When you grow up in a home where there's so much uncertainty, and uncertainty can mean that you're going to be punished in some way because you never know what mood the parent is going to be. You never know whether, you know, they feel in a state where you will just get emotional abuse, or is it going to be something more physical? So you have to prepare yourself. There was always some level of uncertainty and feeling unsafe. So if there was an issue, if I'd broken something or did something or forgot to get something at the shop or whatever it might be, I needed to think very quickly. Solution. You figure out the solution very quickly. You don't, before you even ask anyone for anything, you figure it out yourself. So I learned to be hyper independent from a very, very young age for survival. And then it just became, you know, a very useful skill. If you think of the things that I do now in the world and blah, 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 it is very useful to have the kind of brain that you see a problem and instantly you see a solution. That is how my mind works, right?
Yes.
But then it also means, just like we're saying, it means that at times where you're supposed to feel, so in moments where I have gone through a breakup, something really, really painful, I'll kind of acknowledge, but intellectualize the breakup. Okay, I've broken up with this person for these reasons, so it makes total sense. I feel sad and I feel all of these things, but I let me move on, because if I waste 3 months feeling all, it's a waste of time, whatever the thing might be. So never really being like, okay, there's a solution somewhere there, but right now we need to fucking feel this grief. You're grieving right now, feel it. There would always be that feeling of which sounds so rational when you say it out loud, but that you'll be punished for staying with emotion. If you stay with it for too long, you'll be punished in some way. So you need to figure it out. So in that rejection, when I face that rejection, instantly my mind was like, okay, well, if we can't do that, then we're going to do this other thing. Instantly, I was reaching out to my team to say, okay, let's move that. And then I sort of saw myself in motion, being so upset and sad, but then also being so strategic and just, and I was, no, you're upset. Sit on the sofa and get into fetal position because that feels most comfortable and just have a little cry. That's fine. You get to do that.
Gosh. That's so good. You know, and something the male species could learn from. You know, so we don't just drop down dead from heart attacks because we just bottle shit up our entire fucking life, you know.
Right.
I think it's very useful. It's something that, you know, I'm very, I mean, you know, my amazing wife. I'm very fortunate.
Yes.
You know, in our marriage, you know, and she's somebody who's very deeply sensitive. And she will often say to me, like, you know, maybe it's just good to have a little cry right now. It's good to just sit with this thing, you know.
Yeah.
It's so important to do that. And it's the only way through, you know, it's the only way through. I realize that when I soften into the thing that I am pretending I'm not feeling, but I am. And just acknowledge that something, there's an alchemy that occurs. It's not me. Yes, maybe it is. I don't know. It doesn't feel like me. It feels like something beyond my awareness is moving stuff around. And the next thing I know, I feel better. Right?
Yeah, I love that. And to me, because you mentioned the word vulnerability, you model... And the word model, it feels right here. You really do model a level of vulnerability that I just haven't seen, especially in the context of leaving a cult and sharing the specifics of it, talking about the fact that this wasn't the only cult that you sort of fell into the hands of. There was another one that requires a shit ton of vulnerability to say that I am someone that is very self-aware. I'm someone that is... smart. I know myself as a person, and yet and still I found myself in the clutches of this cult and that one as well. And I think that requires a lot of vulnerability. But I wonder if do you see it actually as vulnerability in sharing the way you do and speaking in the way that you do?
No, I don't. I guess maybe I see it as honesty. Like,
what's the difference?
I don't know. I actually don't know what the difference is. No, you're right. Some of it I see as vulnerability. You know, it was interesting because I had to make a decision when the vow came out. It was all about Nixim, you know. There was a certain amount of vulnerability that I displayed during, because we shot that for 2.5 years.
Really?
And yeah, it was a long process.
Wow.
Because we were documenting everything that was happening as was happening.
Yes.
And part of my struggle was that I was also preparing for a trial that I knew was going to be one of the most difficult things I'd ever have to do in my life. And it was thus far one of the most difficult and worst experiences. So I had to also armor up. And then a part of me was in this, like, I am going to fucking bring this thing to the ground. So there was this very, not cold, but willful warlike feeling. Like I was at war.
Yeah.
So sometimes I was like that, and then I would crack, you know, and there's one moment towards the end of the first season where you just see me, you know, bawling my eyes out because I've just lost it. When the vow came out, the first season, I saw so much, I mean, I'd seen a lot of the cut already, but I saw people reacting to my vulnerability. Some people said things like, you know, thank you so much for expressing those things. And some people just tore into me. Just like, they guess their shadow was deeply buried and it just came out. And they just tore into me. And I was confused. I said to myself, but I was honestly expressing in the moment, you know, what I felt, as confused as I was. So I got very wary of it. And I got a lot of requests for, you know, interviews and live television. I just always said no to live television because I knew there was just more gotcha shit.
Right, yeah.
You know? I think that began to change because I finally realized, like, I'm not doing any favors to anybody by having my shit together all the time. Because I don't have my shit together all the time. And if I'm going to help people understand how these things work, then I have to honestly express where my head was at, what I was going through, what I believed. Because if I do that, maybe they can be like, oh, yeah, that's kind of similar to what I believe or I think or I thought. And, you know, Richard Grannon, who you've now met, and yes, you know, we did this course about called Decoding Cults and Narcissists. And one of the things we talk about in the very beginning is it's really good to know what your wound is. Mm-hmm. There is a lack that all of us as human beings have. That lack, whether we want to admit it or not, sets up propensities for us to make certain decisions. If somebody comes to us and offers us what looks like the perfect match that will heal that lack, we will more than likely go for it. And if they're good at crafting what that is, you know, because people that have these kinds of pathologies, you know, malignant narcissism, sociopathy, psychopathy, can design the perfect key for your lock. And if you refuse to acknowledge that you do have a lock and you do have some kind of wound, because that's the human condition, you're going to get screwed over time and time again until you dig in and see what's going on internally. Yeah. You know, why was I searching for mentors for so long, gurus? I was searching for them because from a very young age, as early as I can remember, age 4, I thought that I wasn't good and I needed to find it. I needed to find somebody that could teach me goodness and maybe it would rub off on me, you know. And so if you're not willing to be vulnerable enough to connect with that, you will not be impervious to people that can play you very easily.
Absolutely.
And so I thought, I have to be able to talk about those things going forward, even though people will want to destroy not the real me, but what I represent in their minds.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I think, yes, it's vulnerability. It's, I guess, as honest as I can be. And sometimes as honest as I want to be, because I have enemies. Yes. Sometimes I don't want to talk about everything because, like, absolutely, you know, I don't want people scouring social media to figure out, like, oh, how do we do? Because, you know, I have, yes, enemies that are, you know, in the cult, still in the cult. I have other enemies related to projects I'm doing. You know, one has to use discretion about, absolutely, how much one shares, as you know.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And thank you for sharing that. And something that I'm curious about, and which is why I'm glad that this conversation that we had today sort of went in different directions than I've heard you sort of go in other conversations, in other interviews, is because something came to mind around identity. Does any part of you ever feel stuck in the identity of Mark, who was in the cult? Do you ever feel stuck in that at all? I'm curious about that piece of things, or however you interpret that question or anything that comes to mind, because it's something I think about a lot, for example, in the context of my work and what I do. I know that everything in my business, with my audience relationships, the perception of who Africa is as a person, it all exploded into the public eye in a different way in 2020.
Yes.
And something that I knew and saw could easily happen is that when people thought of me, they would only and only ever think about this open letter, why I'm leaving the cult of wokeness. Yes. And then I'll end up having to talk about race and politics for as long as I fucking live. That was a big thing that I was very aware of. So I said no to a lot of conversations because I could see as well that it would be so easy to be co-opted by, you know, for example, Fox News wouldn't stop hounding me because they wanted me to have a conversation with Tucker and but I knew what will happen and what I will be participating in, what I would be creating, regardless of my intention and the outcome that I want. My decisions would end up naturally crafting a path for me that I would have to walk regardless. So I was very intentional quite early on about staying focused in my work as a mentor, as a consultant, as a researcher, to really understand self-censorship and self-sabotage, to say no. There will be instances where I talk about race, but that is not my hill. I'm not going to be all over social media talking about race and politics, which is why I love that before we started recording, you were saying there are some specifics you don't want to get into, because I have mine too. Not every private hill needs to be a public hill, right?
No.
But identity is something I think about, in the sense that sometimes you then become known for this one thing, and it can be very difficult to break out of that if you decide you want to explore different things, or to step into a different part of you, or to step more into your creativity, which has nothing to do with any of these other things. Do you ever feel this kind of thing of being somewhat in a golden cage, if you will, that you don't mind being there, but it can easily become a trap? I'm curious about that.
Such a good question. So I have, you know, these two projects I'm doing right now. One is about a cult. Yes, another cult. And another one is about malignant narcissism, narcissistic abuse. But after those two, I have other things I want to explore. And they're things that are not as dark. And I, being known as the cult guy, people expect me to talk about dark things.
Right.
But my eyes are on a horizon. There's other things I want to talk about. I want to talk about solutions. Now, what I find is that, you know, the other day I put a podcast out with this incredible screenwriter friend of mine who lives in Spain. And I was like, oh, that's so few people really wanted to listen to that. That's so interesting. You know, I wonder. And then I thought about it. I said, oh, because we talked about dreams and what's possible. And I thought, well, that's interesting. Does my audience not want those things? And I realized, well, maybe they don't. Maybe they don't. And I thought to myself, so does that mean that I should forever stay the cult guy? And I go, no, I can't do that. I need to go where I evolve. And one of the decisions I made, you know, getting out of this cult is no one's ever going to tell me what to do. You know, I will decide what I do when it feels right for me. And that may go counter to this, that, or the other. So in some ways, yes, I feel the constraining, the golden cage to some degree. Like, people approached me, you know, when The Vow came out and said, oh, let's do this, let's do that. You know, this is the perfect vehicle to talk about politics. And I said, like, politics in general. They said, no, about that party being evil. And I'm like, oh, right. I see. Okay, yeah, that's no. I would say to them, look, the pattern of it, the pattern is what fascinates me, the patterns.
Exactly. I love that.
Yeah, so I do feel that. I do feel that.
Yeah. And you just, something just clicked as soon as you said that, in that, that's exactly why I'm so drawn to your work, and why the word integrity comes up when I think of you, and when I sit with you, and when I listen to you in conversation, even just over the years, is that I don't think you're boxed in any way. I think you can very fluidly move into so many different things because your focus is the pattern. That's exactly it. And I think it's the same thing for me, that through the lens of, let's say, self-sabotage and self-censorship, I can explore how people do that in intimate relationships. I can explore how people do that in sex. I can explore how people do that in money. I can explore how artists do that when they repress their voice. There's so many places to go, because it's always about the pattern. It's not about a specific thing. And to me, your work is the same, and your voice and your curiosity, it's about the pattern of kind of allowing yourself to be, if I'm to put it very simply, what happens when you allow yourself to be led, even though you know that maybe you should be stepping into self-leadership, but you're allowing yourself to be led on a path that you know you shouldn't go down. It's almost like we do similar work in different ways, because ultimately a lot of it is about repression, you know, and you outsource. What happens when you outsource your greatness? What happens when you outsource your thoughts and your mind and your body, or whatever it might be? But it's always, I think, when you allow for it to be about the pattern instead of the specific thing. You don't trap yourself. You get to explore, right?
Yes. You're absolutely right. I was thinking about something as you were saying that, that I thought was fascinating, but it may have escaped me.
It might come back.
The thing for me about the pattern that's so important is exactly what you're saying is, you know, everybody's getting so caught up in you know, specific identities or specific issues. Mm-hmm. And I feel like one of the things that interests me right now, for example, I've been studying as much as I'm able to about, you know, the sort of the Maoist revolution, the stuff that happened, you know, in China, because I'm seeing some of the same things crop up now.
Right.
And I'm thinking, well, that's interesting. Is it that people have not studied history? Because I'm seeing some of the same shit. Like I see some of the patterns of coercion that I saw in South Africa. And this is the great advantage for me of having grown up in South Africa. Is, you know, I got to America and I thought, land of the free, home of the brave, blah, blah, blah. And then starting a few years ago, I was like, oh, no, wait. This is very familiar. Wait, the censorship, this is very familiar. You know, like back in South Africa, words were banned. You know, you couldn't use this word. You couldn't use that word. You couldn't use regime. You couldn't use authoritarian. You couldn't use dictatorial.
Yes.
And then, if memory serves me correctly, at one point, the newspaper, the main newspaper, the most progressive newspaper, printed a blank front page in protest. And then the Minister of fucking whatever affairs in Pretoria said, you may not print a blank paper anymore.
Wow.
I'm like, so I see these things cropping up now and I go, that's interesting. You know, now I'm not trying to get focused on American politics, but I'm interested in the fact that the things that I grew up with when I was in my 20s, you know, busy getting tear gassed and beaten and protesting and all the shit that we went through, which was nothing compared to what people in the townships were going through, I'm seeing some of the same shit again. So the pattern to me is so amazing because, like you said, you get to apply, like, patterns of coercion and abuse are interesting to me.
Yes.
And now I'm looking at patterns of coercion in society at large. And I'm looking at people saying it's for your own safety or it's for the good of the blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, that's very familiar.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And yes, you're right. The self-censorship thing is so interesting to me because I had never, until I looked at your work, I hadn't thought of self-censorship in a larger scale. I'd thought about it very personally, but then I hadn't thought about but then we became part of this larger organism that's self-censoring each other. You know, because we need to censor. We need to self-censor each other. And I was like, oh, that's so interesting. Your work has also really opened things up for me. That's why we can talk forever.
Vice versa. That's why I can't wait. I can't wait to see how we can sort of bring those patterns together from all of those different angles and see what we can create and do. And because this is needed more than ever. The amount of people that I have reaching out to me who grew up in the Soviet Union, who moved, had to escape to come to the West, and now they're seeing the exact same patterns.
Yes.
And we won't listen to those people. We refuse to listen. Even my own family members escaping Zimbabwe to come here. Zimbabwe, a place where you can't speak against the party. You really can't. You can, but there's a very big cost. And this is in 2024, you know. But we're telling these people here in the West to shut up. They know nothing. Educate yourself. You know, it's quite mad. So I think the place where you and I come from, where these things that are so big, be it censorship or whatever else, we bring it back to the self. And I think that's why a lot of people resonate with our work, in that we bring it back to the individual. So it's manageable, you know.
Yes. And, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this, and this is not a new idea, but I keep thinking about projection. You know, when you hate a part of yourself and then you see it out in the world and you want to destroy it because it's a part of yourself. And I think the malaise that I'm seeing, it feels like deep, deep self-hatred and self-loathing. And it's now being externalized, that people that feel that are now externalizing it on other people. you know, I was thinking about the idea. I saw this meme the other day where somebody was saying, you know, people that are doing very, very well don't spend their life criticizing other people.
Mm-hmm.
And so people are not doing very well, but are not willing to do the work it takes to improve whatever, whatever, that projectively want to destroy, you know, the thing that they don't have,
right,
that they want, that they envy. And so I feel like there's this deep self-loathing in society. There's a hatred of humanity because there must be a hatred of self. And I feel like, okay, so that means that we have suppressed so much of our true essence as a species that we're going into this what appears to be quite a rapid decline.
Yeah.
And what if we could stop suppressing, you know, those things? What if the messaging out there was, you're allowed to look at the things that are uncomfortable. You're allowed to look at, you're even allowed to have self-hatred, but let's look at it.
Yes.
You're allowed.
Yes.
You know, you're allowed to have all of those things. There's a teacher who we're now Instagram buddies. You may have heard of him, Kyle Cease.
Kyle Cease? No, I haven't. Please share.
You should check him out. He was a former comedian, and now he's sort of a spiritual teacher, you know. And one of the things I see him always do when he's working with clients is they say, I've got this thing and I feel this thing, and he goes, you're allowed to.
Mm.
You're allowed to.
Mm-hmm.
And to some people, it's a revelation. You know, like that thing you're feeling, the hatred you have for that person, you're allowed to feel that.
Yes.
Because if you're not, it means that you feel this hatred for that person, and you also feel the hatred for yourself for feeling that feeling.
Man.
And now you're fucked. And what you're going to do is you're going to act it out somewhere, somehow.
Oh, absolutely.
And do horrible things to people.
It
and
has
yourself.
To come out. It has to come out eventually. That's something that I even remind myself all the time, because sometimes I might feel something and then I feel annoyed because a part of me thinks, but Africa, you're above this feeling. Like, really? Are we feeling this right now? But then that permission thing is so important, because now I just think, Africa, you're simply the observer. Just observe the feeling, be with the feeling, don't judge it, or at least do your fucking best to not judge it, because it is going to come through anyway. And it's going to do so in a way that is so violent to your spirit if you don't allow for it to just have its little moment and do something with it. It's kind of managing, right?
Yes.
Learning to work with it.
Yeah, it really is. And I feel like if we could do that as a species, man, it would change. Change a lot, you know? If we stop compartmentalizing things into, well, that's a bad thought and that's a good thought. They're thoughts, you know? Like, we're not talking about hacking people to pieces. We're just saying, like, that feeling you're having, it's like we can pretend we're not having the feeling, but we're having it and we're pretending we're not having it. So, like, there it is, you know? And so listen, sometimes I say this as though I know, but sometimes I have to talk to myself and say this to myself.
I hear you.
You're having, and you're trying to suppress it. So there's the feeling you're having and the suppression of the feeling, and they're both unhealthy in combination. So why don't we just admit we're having the feeling? And I talk to myself like this.
Yeah.
You know, like, have you ever had feelings of revenge? Like, I've had revenge fantasies that are insane, mm-hmm. especially coming out of the cult.
Of course, the
shit I wanted to do to my cult leader.
Of course.
And I was so horrified at myself for having them, you know. And then one day I thought, you know, it's make believe. You're allowed. Mm. That's maybe that's why that space is available in you, so that you can play it out without going and hacking somebody to pieces.
Yes.
And so I feel like the self-censorship is that you speak about is so important, because we're even censoring our thoughts. We're even censoring our imaginations.
Yes. And I think that's exactly it. And sometimes we assume that we're censoring the so-called bad thoughts, the so-called wrong thoughts. But actually, that's not the case. You're censoring everything. Because sometimes even the things that are so useful, the things that are beneficial for you and for your community and the world at large, are not going to feel good in the body. But because we tell ourselves that it should feel good in the body and comfortable in the mind, and then it's worth saying out loud. But that's not true, because you could have a very innovative, creative idea, but it makes you feel a bit uncomfortable. But we're censoring all of it. Yeah. And I mean all of it. So I really do think conversations like the one we've had today are just so important, because you're so right. They serve as a permission slip every single time. And sometimes I find that because I speak about these things a lot all the time and I think about them, write about them, it's so easy to think that people already know this. It's so easy to think that. And I'm sure you might get that yourself here and there, because you've been talking about these things for a while, studying, researching, you're having the on the ground conversations and the actual lived experience, that sometimes we can move away from realizing that a lot of people don't even know what a cult is by definition.
Yeah.
A lot of people have no idea what self-censorship means. A lot of people don't, there's so much that I have to remind myself that people don't know, which is why when I have conversations like this, I always try to treat it as if it's the first time, even though I've had hundreds of them and I think about it all the time, because they really do serve as a permission slip for people to be like, oh, we can talk like this. People are allowed to speak like this, because some people will feel bad for even listening to this, because there's that cognitive dissonance of, should I be listening to this kind of conversation? Because it's sort of, so this is so important.
No, you're right. It's interesting. You know, I keep thinking about the self-installed inner critic, you know, and I go back to this, you know, things happen in our childhood and then we try and stay safe. So we not build, but there's a structure in us that wants to police us to keep safe.
Mm-hmm.
So now we'll punish ourselves first before we get punished externally. Yes. And then we forget that we were the one that installed it, so to speak. I mean, it's not strictly like that, but you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So now we walk around with this inner critic who's still a little Nazi. Doing a good job, though. It's doing a very good job. It's trying to keep us safe. And we forget it's even there. It's like this thing from our childhood. And we, because people don't speak like this too often, we people go like, oh, I never thought of that. You know, oh, there's an, what is the inner critic? Well, you know, the inner critic might be a part of your personality that's trying to protect you.
Absolutely.
And its job has come to an end, but it doesn't know that. And now the last thing you want to do is be mad at it. You know, you piece of shit for trying to protect me. No, it just needs a little understanding and acceptance and love. And you've done a great job. I wonder if we could try to do it a little differently now.
That's it.
And there's all these beautiful things we could do if we would just talk about it.
Or even just that that you can change its voice. You can change its clothes. Maybe it's not having, it doesn't have a little Nazi uniform anymore. Now it has, that's how I think of it sometimes.
That's so smart.
Like you can actually just change, like I think being a human being to me is so fucking cool that you can realize something and you can change it. That's crazy to me. Even a simple thing like opening the fridge, and you're not sort of on autopilot that you can't choose. You can say, actually, I don't feel like this today. I'm going to have that.
Yeah.
Choice, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, Mark, I adore you. I know we can speak for a long time. I want to know, you mentioned something about dreams earlier, a conversation you'd had before. What would it look like for you to, if you were to explore that side of the conversation a little bit more, the things that are not so dark and heavy, et cetera, what are some of the things that you want to play around with, even in conversation?
Yeah, I think that you know, going through hell is yes, it's difficult. Everybody has gone through some kind of hell.
Yeah.
Everybody's gone through some kind of trauma. You know, it's in the end, it's all relative to the person. But in going through that, like this hero's journey, there are these gifts that you get. There are treasures you get. The greatest treasure to me is the self-knowledge, self-awareness, and hopefully eventually, you know, self-love. And there's a fullness about that that is indescribable as it grows. And it feels like it has no end. I'm interested in that. I'm interested in what are the gifts that myself and other people have gotten from the hell that, you know, we've all gone through in different ways. And then, you know, I did a podcast about religion earlier and I thought to myself, you know, there's other thing I'm thinking about is we're all stuck in not only our own personal identity, but related to that, believing in certain identities. You know, like I talked about how, you know, if I'm in the bush as a kid having a spiritual experience and I'm standing in front of a big rock, now I think the big rock caused it. As happened, you know, as I was out in the bush a lot as a kid and, you know, in my 20s, you know, going on, I suppose, African walkabouts, I suppose you could call it. That thing that we think is coming from the rock or the baobab tree or the whatever or the sky, that thing is in us. We're bouncing off a symbol of some kind. You know, and I talked about, you know, like you go to church. I think they're all symbols. I think they're all symbols of something much more fundamental. And, you know, I listen to like, you know, mathematicians and, you know, physicists. They talk about this elusive something. And it sounds very much like what I'm talking about here. There's something fundamental. The fundamental nature of existence cannot be computed by the brain. But it's very beautiful, very profound, and it's very close. So eventually, I'd like to go back to talking about some of those things in a deeper way and reflect back on what is it to be a fully embodied human being. Mm-hmm. Not a bypassy, spiritually bypassy person, a fully embodied human being where I am not at war with myself. I am, for now, the identity I may have for now is a container that contains all of these feelings and these thoughts. I might be much more than that, but that my identity increases from, you know, my genetics and the way I was raised and the color of my skin and this and that and then da 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 and gets bigger and bigger and bigger. That identity expands.
Yes.
That to me is fascinating. Because, as well, one of the byproducts of what I'm suggesting is, and I know people are going to be like, how dare you? How dare you talk about identity, you fucking racist, misogynistic, white supremacist, blah, 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 blah. But the expansion of identity, I believe, would cause the slowing down of an enormous amount of conflict, because the expansion of identity would mean there would be less self-loathing and self-hatred because you'd become to accept so much more of who you are. And I think, therefore, you'd come to accept so much more of who other people are.
Absolutely.
And you start to have curiosity. Like, I'm genuinely curious when I run into somebody that is so far out of my frame of reference. You know, sometimes I bump into artists who are just, you know, I met an artist the other day in Lisbon, so flamboyant and so crazy in this guy, so handsome, and he's all kinds of this, and I'm thinking, like, I'm so far from that, but this is fascinating, you know, as opposed to, oh, that's so different.
Yes.
You know, like, I think I'm a liberal in the truest sense of the word. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I went to drama school in South Africa. I mean, we were fucking crazy. You know, I am open-minded as much as I am able to be open-minded. I'm just fascinated at this experience of being human. And so all these things I've just mentioned are things that I want to get to. I want to continue my hero's journey from pain and confusion and a complete, what felt like a complete loss of identity, to finding out what the gifts are and then talking about it. Because I feel on a deep level, as much as I may hold back at times, that there is, I'm here for a reason. Mm-hmm. Call me delusional. I'm here for a reason. And the things that I am speaking about now, it feels like my whole life has led up to me saying the things I'm saying now. Yes. And it feels so damn right. Mm. You know?
That's powerful. I wrote down from loss of identity to reclamation to sharing about the reclamation. That's incredible. I absolutely adore you, and I cannot wait for you to come back so we can have another conversation.
We will.
See what we can do out there in the world. Like we were saying outside of this recording, I really think people are craving in-person gatherings where these conversations yes. happen in a room and you can feel people's energy and you can see body language and you can see the real life pauses and the sort of, yeah, I'm so excited to just see what we can do, what we can create, because these conversations are not, they're not just something you listen to and you're like, huh, okay, and you go about yeah. your day. They really leave an impression in one way or another. They really do. I thank you so, so much.
Thank you so much.